I have to say that this place and the whole presence, saturation of Freud in London and the mythology of London has focused almost everything I've done. I didn't grow up in London. I grew up in South Wales, and I came to London, to Brixton, to South London, to go to a film school. And after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and some time in Ireland, I settled not too far from here. Obviously, I couldn't last. You know, this was a sort of moment of desperate privilege, being allowed to live in Hampstead in a small bedsitter before they all vanished. But there were these few golden months. And the very first thing I did that actually laid out a path for everything that's followed, and it was done by, I don't know what strange instinct, was to make my first London derive without any notion of writing about it. But it was instinctive to go to Golders Green Crematorium, pay my respects to the ashes of Freud, dragging a few people with me. We then limped our way down to Highgate and saw the head of Karl Marx, drifted down to Royal College Street and saw the house where Rambo had lived, and then hit the canal, and not knowing where we were, just carried on through one great tunnel in Islington. We had to go over the top, and finally finished up in a strange deserted park that was Victoria Park in Hackney, a place I'd never really heard of or known, and came out of there and found this pub, sat down and exchanged stories of the walk, and realized that actually I haven't done anything different or better in the 50 years that have followed that day. And yet, you know, in all of this time, even though I used to work as a gardener, as I remembered in the streets going up here, and my daughter went to school not very far away, I'd never actually been in this house until I did this circular walk. Circular walk is a kind of necklace of London, and I've been looking as part of my projects for years. My own form of analysis, psychoanalysis, is to psychoanalyze the terrain, the territory, to be out there, preferably in company with somebody else. And you're walking side by side, and there is a kind of exchange that's different to the hierarchy of the patient on the couch and the analyst sitting behind or out listening to the voice of the person who's telling their story and teasing out a narrative, listening very intently and doing all that. The walk is another form of analysis. It allows the city to become part of the story, to give you things all the time, and that you're moving as equals. You're side by side, you're parallel, your eyes are focused outwards, you're not really looking at each other. And this induces a sort of reverie of confession. And that becomes the form of the writing and also the form of the books that I'm doing. And in this case, the book started out as a sort of exorcism or a stepping away from the moment where my locality was no longer local. It would become part of that global corporate entity that we're now seeing falling apart with FIFA, that we're now seeing with Alberto Salazar and his drug regimes. Underwriting those enormous projects is a sense of sort of significant corruption and deception. And this invaded London and took the landscape that was my landscape of reverie and memory in the Lower Lee Valley, where there were so many things like allotments that people had worked for all of the years since the war and had formed communities that were being broken up. The communities of travellers were being dispersed. The land itself was heavily contaminated with radioactivity from the Second Industrial Age, and all of that was being ignored in this enormous virtual event. And it came to a crunch for me when at Cheltenham, in a literary festival, I was down there with a quite a heroic writer called Laura Oldfield Ford, who's also an artist, and also worked a lot with children in the area of the Lower Lee Valley. And everything she said was specific to her own experience. It was an authentic narrative. And yet, this audience that was gathered in Cheltenham started to murmur and mutter as she made these remarks about this landscape that she knew and what had happened to it. And opposing this was a journalist, a sports journalist, who obviously had a deeply vested interest in the whole project, and an Olympic oarsman who had a phenomenal sense of entitlement. I chatted to him before, and he was just saying, well, which charity do you think would hire me to front them up, you know, and could they go over 250,000? And I was seeing, you know, for the first time that all this amazing kind of self-sacrifice to produce this Olympic thing was actually to do with creating this entity that would become part of something else. And Laura Oldfield-Ford, by the time she'd finished and was going to get her food, was almost lynched. So I realized that we were persuaded entirely by the virtual over the real, that all of that enclosure of landscape and computer-generated imagery blanketing us over and over and over again had created this thing I wanted to walk away from. And in walking away from it, I stumbled by accident on this old railway, which I knew very well, and I'm sure a lot of other people knew, the North London Line, which was being conveniently rebranded as the Ginger Line, and quite accidentally went all the way around London. It made a complete circuit. Went all the way from me to the river, across the river, round to Clapham, and then back. You know, you had to change trains in Clapham, but then you'd come all the way back round to Hackney. So there was this circuit, which was a kind of description of the totality of the culture of London and how it was changed and affected by the railway. And what would happen, I thought, if we went round this entire circuit in just one day? So I could find one person mad enough to walk with me, who was Andrew Cotting, filmmaker who I'd been involved with. And he agreed to do this, but he, unfortunately, I like to start these walks about 6 o'clock in the morning, so you get up the first light and you move. And he couldn't get there till 10:30 or something, which meant we were plodding. When we come to here, it was night. So we passed, I dragged him to the door here. We had to bow and pay our homage to Freud's house, but we couldn't actually go into it at that point. So I came back later, and that became really the sort of Bunyan-esque city on the hill. It became the secret target and motor of the whole operation, because it brought back to me the way that the whole idea of a psychoanalysis and the cult of that had sort of slipped in a slurry right down the hill into the days of the 1960s when I lived here, with people like R.D. Lang, who I visited in Belsize Park in his basement, David Cooper and all the anti-psychiatrists. There was this kind of excitement that still played off the myth of the original, and that original was such a rich and enveloping narrative. So I want to start, you know, by just giving you the momentum of a short part of this book. I've extracted little cameo snapshots that represent each of the stations. The stations become like stations of the cross in a weird pilgrimage. And the place to start is obviously just crossing the river. I don't want to take you through the whole thing. But if I started down at the river, this weird place that's called Chelsea Harbour, which is not in Chelsea, it's not a harbour, but it is almost like a kind of Russian version of seizing back Crimea. It's like Roman Abramovich can have his yacht out front and the Chelsea Football Club on the other side, and there's this zone of weirdness that goes back to sort of to cover up all the traces of the old coal docks and things that were there, and to have a railway station that allows you into this link of this thing that's going to carry you all around London in this dream narrative. So I'm just going to go quickly, station by station by station, dropping in these cameos that'll bring us up to where we are now before we can get into the real business. Imperial Wharf, wonderful name. That's Canada Water, and there's a station right alongside. The ramp leading from the reality of Lofts Road to the overground is a causeway of unconvinced interventions that are not quite sculpture and not quite propaganda. For a couple of hundred yards, the Imperial Wharf approach is the drive into town from a new airport in a new country, using up its euro budget. A mirrored water feature slab says Chelsea Harbour. A line of taxis with engines thumping. A giant pair of severed grey hands dumped into a mesh cage for potential refurbishment. Green and blue periscope towers. Novelty flats built in expectation of the railway effect blind roundabouts, contradictory road markings, humming vaults where machines are housed to keep the whole complex ecosystem breathing. West Brompton. The dead are a logistical nuisance in expanding cities. They offer a poor return for short-term property investors. In Brompton, the concept was always theatrical architecture, an aspect stressed by the designer Benjamin Bode, in order that this railside halt could compete with the rustic attractions of suburban burying grounds like Nunhead and Highgate. Brompton Cemetery was a city of extinguished Londoners built for 250,000 souls. Victorian cemeteries were the original garden cities. A demonstration, perhaps, that utopian theme parks for the good life are much better suited to citizens who will never move again. Here was a sculpture garden dressed with 35,000 eccentric monuments to the wealthy and the established, almost all of whom are now forgotten. Kensington Olympia. The old gods are expelled from Olympia and the lords of enterprise culture ejected from Earl's Court with the erection of Richard Rogers' new Labour tent on Bugsby's Marshes, East Greenwich. Smart money moved east. There was more waste ground and fewer regulations. Kensington was covertly decanted into the kind of ghost town left behind by gold rush fever or a dry oil well. The stucco was as frosty as ever, the villas and the mansion blocks intact, unravished, but the former inhabitants are priced out or replaced by remote investors. The Royal Borough was a manifestation of monopoly mania, a property speculating, money laundering board game with the right to buy but not occupy. Shepherd's Bush. Shepherd's Bush, Westfield, achieves critical non-mass. It's an all-year-round winter wonderland made from synthetic ice. The scale and density is manageable without an induction course. The compass is not wholly subverted. Treat the skating rink floors and celestial ceilings like a walk-through park, and it's harmless. But the heavier Stratford version is more of a black hole, a Gormenghast swallowing life as we know it for a dole of recycled air. The permanently interim quality of the surrounding post-Olympic terrain is a microclimate of choking dust, gouged pits, septic ponds, rubble dunes, mingling with infinitely small particles of sand from the Sahara. Already this speculation is sub-zoning into knots of hanging out, non-attending school kids sucking cans, lost souls on the rubber corridors of decommissioned hospitals, and misdirected travellers condemned to endless circuits while they search for an exit to daylight. Willesden Junction. The perimeter fence of the station at Willesden Junction defines the point of transit from road use to a sudden sunken railway community. Passengers dissolve on concrete ramps and metal-sided walkways. Recorded announcements in no recognizable language are muffled by the acrid smoke of evening. Night cancels time. Whatever discomfort we've experienced from hours of pounding pavements and hours more stretching ahead of us is absolved with a loss of detail and the blurring of outline. The orange-gold blots of surveillance electricity burn aureoles in natural darkness. We turn back, we cross the busy road and we head east with a sense that at long last we are coming home. We feel very good about it. Andrew Cotting kisses his stuffed monkey. Kensal Rise. The Kensal Rise tent is anti-library. It doesn't let books out, it gathers them in until protesting shelves are multi-stacked and groaning. Well, this is a shrine to conspicuous altruism. You could build a section of the Berlin Wall with the mounds of unwanted titles. Daniel Martin by John Fowles. The Ebony Tower. He Who Fears the Wolf by Karen Fossman. Farewell Horizontal by K.W. Jetta. Sad Orphans are horizontally stacked in alphabetical order. A handwritten note begs patrons, please keep book donations at home. Brondesbury Park. Devante Keane, known also as Devon Sawyer, was pulled over as he strolled between the Overground Railway and the tennis club close to Brondesbury Park Station. Devante was stopped and searched on suspicion of being in possession of drugs. The suspicion might have related to his appearance in this quiet suburban place. Photographs posted on the net show a confident young man in wraparound shades, white t-shirt and gold necklace. They show a playful, scar-faced gangster pose with brandy and cigar, like a football enthusiast, computer games buff, an Amsterdam tourist and keen socializer. Devante was down the line, well away from his home turf in Mark's Tay, near Colchester. He was an Essex boy. Devante ran. He ran into scenes familiar from Dalston to Enfield, helicopters overhead, dog unit, blue flashing cars, the full paramilitary urban response squadron. He turned Willesden Green into a parkour demonstration. He hurdled hedges. He sprinted through gardens. He rolled over fences and swerved through cars in late afternoon spurts of commuter traffic. In brief surveillance stardom, he was lit from above by searchlight beams. He was deafened by the clatter of blades, pursued by a chorus of sirens. The manhunt lasted for around 40 minutes. Access to the railway is easy. I can see how slithering through the bushes of the embankment might feel like reaching the Rio Grande and crossing into Mexico in a Sam Peckinpah movie. Devante Keane was pronounced dead at the scene, having been struck in headlong flight by a mainline train operated by Chiltern Railway shortly after 5 p.m. The police complaints to commission announced they would not be carrying out an investigation. Brondesbury. At every roundabout, at every point where a crossroad bridges the track, we detour, we peer over the railway wall, we cut through tangled foliage to be sure that the blunt, yellow-nosed trains are still in service. The unit prices of desirable properties are surely climbing as we move east, but it's more Morlock land than Metro land. There's a certain residual gloom that goes with the safety of being this far out, but out from where? Chinese whispers we can't quite hear rumble through the continuous shrouded terrace as if the miles and miles of bow-fronted conformity made up one single railway mansion. West Hampstead. Coming now in the evening of the overground circuit to exiled parts of London that are disturbingly familiar, the people on the street begin to look more like themselves. They look like characters I think I've known. Book dealers, jobbing translators, migrant Russian women hosting vodka seances to make a scene out of unpromising West Hampstead materials. We're weary enough after the haul through Brondesbury and Kilburn to let the fantasies through and the self-directed dramas of consolation and reward. In the sodium-gaudy darkness, Andrew's sunglasses have passed beyond eccentricity into mimetic blindness. The lecherous grin on the face of his stuffed monkey is justified. Finchley Road and Frognal. At Finchley Road and Frognal, where the pulse of north-flowing traffic is felt, the overground becomes an underground, tunnelling into London clay. This notion engages Andrew. Around this point, so he says, our most recent glacier put on the brakes, and the white tongue of the optimistically named Last Ice Age ground to a halt. Viennese cafes nudge against the axial moraine, dispensing elaborate pastries and serious coffee. Motorists in their pods are preparing themselves for the bifurcation of the M1 and the A1, and small enterprises along this nervous stretch are being replaced by the shadowy windows of brand leaders. So here we are. We've come round one charge of the circuit, and this obviously carries on the whole way round. My son, who was reading this book, sort of rang up and said, I actually managed to read it. For once, he said, you haven't done any real digressions. And I thought, oh my God, this is a complete failure, you know, because the digression is the whole source of it. And the only serious digression, really, is this place, Freud's Museum, because having completed the day's walk, very late at night, we limped back into Hackney about 2 o'clock in the morning. I knew that I had to come immediately back, and I set out the next day to, first of all, to check the sites around Willesden Junction, where the painter Leon Kossoff had painted and worked, because I think there's a very interesting form of analysis that's going on here between painters and psychiatrists, which is this, that... Well, obviously you see the connection if you go downstairs and on that beautiful home movie, there's this moment of the young Lucian Freud as a schoolboy walking out to the goldfish pond with his grandfather. And that was so important to Lucian, this connection, that the reason, I believe, so he says, that he initially fell out with his two brothers is that they tried to say jokingly that he was not the true biological son of Ernst, and therefore he was not in the lineage of Sigmund, which was so important, that his whole career in staring so intently at his sitters for many, many hours was a kind of replication of that act of analysis, where you sit and listen so intently, looking for these tiny clues that remake the damage. And that, you know, in a sense, is an exilic quality that is so important to what we are drawing on in London now. And that this house where the accident, really, of a year or so's life becomes something that informs and enriches the nature of the place itself and makes it worthy of this sort of enormous pilgrimage journey around London. And in parallel to that, you know, obviously, Lucian was very closely associated with painters like Auerbach, who carry on the same process of intense interrogation of the image. Near railways, he's always worked quite close to King's Cross, in that sort of area, where Auerbach has scratched off each day's work and carries on again. And his great friend and colleague and associate was Leon Kossoff. And Kossoff had started as a child around Arnold Circus in Shoreditch, where his father had a bakery, Kossoff's Bakery. And his life had seemed to be part of the journey of the railway, including the kind of backstory of, obviously, the dark side of the railway and all of that, what that involved in terms of relatives in Germany and Poland. And in London, here he is. He moves first to Hackney, and in the 70s he has a studio right on the railway alongside the German hospital. German hospital is a phenomenally significant site. The Ridley Road Market on one side, the German hospital on the other. German hospital was had fallen into the hands of serious sort of German fascist pastors who were preaching kind of extreme forms of anti-Semitism within that setup. But it had also, in earlier times, been where Joseph Conrad had come when he'd been damaged in the Congo. He'd come back and gone into the German hospital in Hackney for recuperation, because he'd lived in Stoke Newington. And he actually teased out the whole Heart of Darkness scenario in that German hospital. So here's Leon Kossoff above the railway, doing really phenomenal, dark, intricate, dense images of the development that was going on in the 1970s, but kind of anticipating the complete destruction and makeover of this territory of Dalston Lane that came much later. And then he moves down the railway to Willesden and has a studio in Willesden, looking out over the spread of tracks and seeing that as a really enormous event horizon in a really beautiful way that gives us a sense of London as being monumental and interconnected with all of Europe in all sorts of ways. And now lives in nearby in Willesden Green, again right on the railway, and he's doing those older man paintings of a decaying cherry tree propped up and grandchildren running about and these trains flashing past at the bottom of the garden. And so that life story of Kossoff, sort of I looked at first and then walked from there to this house and began to absorb the sort of some part of the density of what Freud had brought us by coming to London in that moment of difficulty and challenge as a relatively sick man, but making such an important contact. And that reminded me again of how in walking with Andrew, the kind of the damage of, or the backstory of both of our lives are teased out just as we walk through day and night in the course of this book across the whole manifest of the map of London, and which allows me to remember Angela Carter in Clapham, where she lived, or J.G. Ballard at Chelsea Harbour. The sort of set of his novel Millennium People is obviously based around that. All of these things happen, and they're very nice, they're very important, but really the resolution comes here with this, and then dropping down as the night goes on to Royal College Street, where Rambo and Verlaine arrive together, very excited by the first days of the railway, the first days of those underground. But maybe the most significant and somewhat related, I'm allowed a digression, I think one digression, part of this was as we came to Finchley Road, the main discussion we were having was about the right poet, John Clare. We were hoping that we would make a film about John Clare. I'd written a book a few years back called Edge of the Horizon, which was recapitulated Clare's journey from Epping Forest when he discharges himself or escapes from an asylum run by Matthew Allen and walks for 3.5 days through the hottest weather in July back to his home village. And it is one of the great psychoanalytical episodes, because what has created this state of mind where Clare is? That he's disturbed, as I was, by the nature of enclosure, that his own village has disappeared. The landscape of his village has been changed by the Agricultural Enclosure Acts. The common land is no longer common. He can't walk the paths that he's always walked. And therefore he doesn't know himself. He says, I go out of my knowledge. He walks in a way that suddenly the creatures, the birds and the stones and the trees that he knows and that know him don't know him any longer. Therefore he doesn't really exist. And he also has to come to London to present himself as a celebrity peasant poet. And he meets people like De Quincey and Coleridge, but London has to be configured for him in terms of what he knows in Peterborough. It doesn't work. Everything falls apart. He thinks he's being imprisoned in Epping Forest for the crime of bigamy, because his muse, his childhood muse, Mary Joyce, is still very active in his mind. And he's married, he knows he's married to Patty, but in this situation in the forest, he's in enforced celibacy, and it's disturbing him in a serious way. And in the end, he meets these travellers who are passing through, who suggest that he should walk out, and he undertakes this journey. So that as Andrew and I are doing this walk, I'm pushing him to try and do a film about this journey. And that film resolves itself almost at the point of reaching Finchley Road and Frognall. And we decide that we will go and pay a trip to the Oxford sort of village where the actor, now senior actor, Freddie Jones lives. Freddie Jones, early 1970s, played John Clare for BBC's Omnibus in the day when they used to do those kind of things. There was a film about this escape from Epping Forest. And it was watched by 4-year-old Toby Jones, who's now a very celebrated actor, saw his father, Freddie, playing John Clare, this mad, disturbed poet on the road, and Toby's mother was playing Mrs. Clare. And Freddie is taken away and put in an asylum, and Toby was deeply disturbed by this. And so the opportunity to play Clare in our film was sort of a resolution to the situation with his father, who felt that the Clare thing was one of the great roles of his life, but it had never been resolved, never given him the sort of satisfaction or position that he thought it should have done. So within this film, Toby is completely silent, and his father voices him, so he's haunted by the voice of the father in a kind of Hamlet-like way. And all of those ideas came to us right here as we advanced on this house. And I think, in a sense, some of those kind of Oedipal conflicts and things which I was sucking out of the house even though we couldn't get into it became part of that story. I'd just like to read a fraction of that as well. If the thickening night and the fugue-like weariness referenced our swan pedalo voyage, that's the previous thing with Andrew, It led me to tempt Andrew with Tales from the Road, the John Clare walk out of Epping Forest on those blistering summer days. It was the notion of becoming a straw bear that really sold it. As we inspected the underwater glaze of the patterned wall of green bricks near West Hampstead Thames Link Station, I could see the physical transformation begin. A slump of the shoulders, a lumbering walk. There were claws sprouting. There was matted hair spiking into plaits of straw. Andrew was channeling Herzog's grizzly man. His belly was growling, and he peered suspiciously at the Hampstead horizon as if he was seeing the Alaskan tundra. His actions cast me into the Timothy Treadwell part, the nutty bear-watching obsessive who comes to a very sticky end and is killed and eaten off-camera with live sound. The film of the Clare Walk should have to be done, budget or no budget, and we closed in on territory associated with the London exile and the last years of Sigmund Freud. The bear fetish took on flesh and made itself available for analysis. Anxiety hysteria in the form of animal possession sounded very much like a suitable case for treatment. A few weeks after recovering from our London overground exertions, we drove to Oxfordshire to seek out Freddie Jones, the veteran actor who, having played Claire with such bug-eyed conviction, was now the keeper of the spirit. Freddie lived in a converted chapel in a quiet village, not far from a decommissioned US Air Force base. The abandoned silos and the deep bunkers suggested an ideal location in which to record the poems of Claire's madness. Freddie was alone with his posters, the glory days of performing for Fellini in And the Ship Sails On. An elegant coffee tray had been set out by his absent wife. He was a mime of gracious welcome. He waved us towards the tray with all kinds of amusing business, but he didn't have a clue how coffee was actually prepared. So Andrew stepped in. He was in high register mode too. He was spilling anecdotes and thrusting books at the unprepared actor, swooping and circling, and beyond all else registering his genuine conviction that Freddie was a great figure and the only possible man for this job. "Shall we make the coffee a little more interesting?" Freddie said, reaching for the whiskey bottle. After two or three cups, the coffee element was left out of the mix entirely. "I see passages of quiet contemplation," Andrew bluffed. "The straw bear wandering at the end of his tether across a busy motorway in the forecourt of a happy eater, or stood still in the middle of a ploughed field underneath a wind turbine foregrounded by electricity pylons." "Bear? Bear? What bear? Ooh, this is delightful," said Freddie. In his snowy white beard with wisps of hair above his pink cheeks, Freddie was the King Lear of Emmerdale. He had a driver to take him up to Leeds for his appearances in the popular television soap. "Costs me more than my fee," he muttered, but the addiction was still there to steal scenes with his electric disability carriage. When Freddie slurped and sipped, remembering the earlier Claire, but not where he'd left his VHS tape of the performance, and anticipating with some excitement and necessary doubt his future engagement with a director as mad and visionary as any from the past, the frown and inward gaze of the poet's lost mind was projected across his private face. He started to recite with perfect recall the song of the road and all of its pains. Claire, in the seizure of inspiration, in his forest incarceration, jumped forward to describe what was still to come. "Life to me a dream that never wakes. Night finds me on this lengthening road alone. Love is to me a thought that ever aches, a frost-bound thought that freezes life to stone." And so we plodded up the hill and came right past her and stopped and paid our respects. And then I began to think that this whole business of the digging of the underground, the tunnelling of the railway in that great optimistic railway age, Victorian railway age, kind of coincided with Freud's beginning to dig into the unconscious. So that actually we were, if you can think of London as I do now after all these years, as a sentient being, then this process was a kind of metaphor that connected up rather beautifully with this house. And the other aspect I thought of was that The evolution of Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes and Freud were very somehow connected, and there's the two addresses, the 20 Maresfield Gardens and 22B Baker Street, were equally mythical. I mean, one was not real and the other fiction. They were both there. They were both lodged into this mythology of London in great ways. And the methods of the two people were so similar. This idea of listening so intently, watching for clues, making interpretations from tiny, tiny details. And the interest in cocaine, I mean, there was a lot that put these two together. And also, in some ways, that Freud may be more like a Holmes opposite, a contrary, like a Moriarty figure, because he's alien, he's exotic, he's Jewish, he comes out of Austria, he has this astonishing collection of Egyptology, these images and artifacts that are around him that seem like an extension of his mind, a whole field of this stuff, which you can see Sherlock Holmes looking at with enormous interest and seeing the dust patterns of where it's moved across the desk and the recreation of this library. I thought the two were deeply, deeply interconnected in the way that my vision of what London is depended on these two figures. And coming into the house enforced that, in a sense. Just being able to look at the couch and being able to look at the library with that sense of room with the curtains drawn. There was something important was kept. And the idea of doing these kind of events and talks is a way of engaging the contemporary with this plural sense of time, which is also available by these endless circuits. Because what happens on one of these circuits is there's no way off. The earlier one I did more dramatic, you know, was the M25 motorway, the orbital motorway, which took a whole year to go round in a series of one walk every month for a year. The main thing about that experience was the experience that, you know, there was no reason to stop. You could go round and round and round this thing forever. And the only way off was the two crossings of the Thames, the one on the west side, which linked up with H.G. Wells and War of the Worlds and invasion technologies, and the one on the east side that linked up entirely with Dracula and Bram Stoker's Abbey at Purfleet. So you had these two exits into metaphors taken from 19th century science fiction or fantasy. What would be the exit to the overground railway? The exit in the end for the motorway was to break away from Epping Forest when we got there, which was the conclusion of my loop at Waltham Abbey, and to head off following John Clare's path from High Beech in the forest to the village he'd come from, Helpston, which so happened to be where my wife's family had come from, so that led us into a whole other story. I don't know what the one was with this, and I think the one out of this was, again, to John Clare to make the film by ourselves with Andrew Cotting, which was to use this kind of interesting Hamlet, Oedipal situation between Freddie and Toby Jones, these two very fine actors, one all rich, ripe voice, one all intricate, physical, tiny, detailed performance, and to try and absorb into that the memories of the Overground Walk. And it was perfect. And essentially the play out is to go the next stage beyond this, down to Royal College Street, where I was able to get into the house where Rambo and Verlaine had lived, and was quite shocked in stepping through the front door to be confronted by a giant oil painting of Margaret Thatcher. The guy who owns the house saw me reel back. And he said, don't worry, I'm not a conservative. No, I'm UKIP. But he also, you know, had taken on this idea, even though Rambo was there for even less time than Freud, that houses have to become these museums of memory. That he tried in a way to recreate or make theatre out of the presence of somebody who passes through the city and is an enormous walker. I was very interested to hear this about the Freud as a walker, the way that, and also the way that he projected the idea of hysteria against these specific monuments in London that do cry out to say something. They do cry out to become part of a narrative. So I think I'll kind of probably finish off with a little extract from the Freud and Maresfield Gardens thing, whereby I try and bring together the sense of the burrowing underneath with the burrowing into the mind and the kind of privileges we get by this strange exile of somebody arriving here by railway. The most potent retrieval, the one that transfixed me in front of the monitors in that Maresfield Garden dining room, that's not the one I want to read, but I'll just say that because it's there, because it's true, as the souvenir painting of the Alpine region where Freud loved to walk, showing a young relative, a youth in flannels, blazer, open neck, white shirt, playing his respects to his grandfather. The youth was Lucian Freud, innocent of the will to challenge the camera as an instrument of record. Lucian walks beside the fading old man across the lawn to a fish pond. Lucian and Sigmund, side by side for an instant, affect the matter of London. The official story in the guidebook does not record this visit, but the letters from the young Lucian are on display in a glass case. Lieben Pap, we have put up the model railway. Have you already built the skyscraper? Perfect. And if the thickening night and the most potent retrieval, the one that transfixed me in front of the monitors. No, we've done that. Right. One more. Here we go. There seemed to be a valid connection between Freud's excavation of the unconscious, the impacted layers of repression and fantasy, and the physical tunnelling into the lobes of London, the glacial moraine. The railway interventions in the clay mantle were extreme. They were a forced lobotomy for Finchley and Frognall. The Hampstead Junction Railway, later the Broad Street Line, later the North London Line, later London Overground, was an associate of the LNWR, and it came into being to link Camden Town and the NLR with Willesden and the NSWJR, an alphabet soup of railway companies and their parasitical developments carving up territory in the teeth of geography, subverting patterns of flow, the springs and streams percolating through silt and sand. Hampstead the spa, the retreat, grew up around restorative waters, quacks in gaudy waistcoats, bottling the springs for sale at threepence a flask, declared that Hampstead waters were a stimulant diuretic, very beneficial in chronic diseases arising from languor of the circulation, general debility of the system, or laxity of the solids. Underground water collected in basins of clay flooded the tunnels. The invaders burrowed, shaping ledges for men and machinery. They burrowed again. Streets were lost, dwellings demolished. Much of the present surface as we pass among the neat villas and regimented gardens is dirt from railway excavations, gaping tunnels covered over with replenished and compacted soil. The metaphors are clumsy. They won't go away. Freud, nursing his cancerous jaw and keeping off flies drawn to the ripe stench of bone rot with acrid cigar smoke, listens to the stories, playing and replaying significant details, teasing out explanations that read like crafted fictions. They're like detective stories in yellow-backed shilling shockers, the Wolfman, the lurid confessions of Anna O, studies in hysteria, Conan Doyle's A Study in Scarlet. The tunnel between Hampstead Heath and Finchley Road was constructed in the 1859, 3 years after the birth of Sigmund Schlomo Freud in Moravia. Financial considerations meant that the bore of the gaping hole crossing Finchley Road and trepanning Arkwright Road was narrow. The soil was slippery and unreliable. Records giving a contemporary account of why this tunnel had to be tighter than the others were not kept. Sealed carriages slid through the dark. Passengers were tense, folded into themselves, impatient for the return of daylight. Freud and railways escape. He travels from Vienna to Paris, a deal brokered with the Nazis after shaming extractions. Documents signed, fraudulent claims settled, so the collection of books and antiquities can be shipped out of Austria to Maresfield Gardens, June 1938. It's one of those cinema escapes, last train, misty windows, closed frontiers, France, sisters left behind, the dog, a chow, is brought out to perform after quarantine in home movies on the Hampstead lawn, the final birthday. A passenger train transports Freud into London, Victoria Station, newsreel cameras, magnesium flares, flashing like the assassination in Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent. London welcomed the facsimile of the man, this cultural trophy, like a hieratic Egyptian figurine to be stored in the British Museum. Broadsheets congratulated themselves on their advocacy of psychoanalytical fad, their liberality in letting such a distinguished alien step ashore and seeing him settled in a suitable quarter of the town. The obvious fragility, the fact that Freud was so close to death, added poignancy to the scene. The swagger of his earlier portraits with watch chain and gambler's drooping bow tie and black cigar were as much Doc Holliday as Viennese medical man. The repeated and barbaric acts of surgery conducted on Freud's jaw, the cancerous lumps hacked out, the crudely inserted prosthetics belonged to the kind of dentistry that Doc Holliday might have practiced. Freud dosed himself with a couple of aspirins and a fat cigar and carried on. Nay, moriari mori, he said, to prevent death by dying. Another train to Manchester to visit his half-brother Emmanuel in 1875 and his sister Rosa in 1884-5. And this film of Railway England, the fields and the factories, as witnessed through the smoke, made a deep and lasting impression. Emmanuel died on 17th of October, 1914, out of falling out of a train travelling between Manchester and Stockport. A later Manchester migrant arriving as a lector at the German department of the university and conscious of the implications of following in the tracks of the philosopher Wittgenstein was W.G. Sebald. The bricks of Sebald's retreat in Kingston Road, Didsbury, was not as red as Maresfield Gardens, part of a tactful development, not a custom-built Hampstead mansion with 8 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, designed in 1920 by Albert Hastelow in the revivalist style and improved by Freud's architect's son, Ernst, who installed a lift to transport the ailing analyst from one floor to the next. But trains were the weave of Sebald's prose. How many cavernous stations with abandoned waiting rooms? How many station hotels with slits looking out on brick walls and strands of ominous wire? How potent the urge at the end of all that restless journeying to just lie down on the tracks?
Thank you very much. That set my imagination and mind spinning, not just round London, but through Freud's own past. And now I'm seeing it again through Ian's eyes. I'm glad that you pointed out the curious effect of railways in his own life. You pointed out the death of his half-brother falling from a train in 1914. It goes back before then. His first vision of hell was in a railway station in Breslau at the age of 3 or 4. This is all in the interpretation of dreams. You go through the interpretation of dreams, you'll find railways again and again. There's this weird dream he has overnight in a closed carriage on a train and wakes up wanting to pee and he can't get out of the carriage. In fact, this strange influence of trains goes on beyond his death. A few years ago, the Austrian National Railway brought out a poster to advertise, showed a picture of Freud and Anna looking out of a train carriage, and it was to advertise Austrian Railways. It was then pointed out to them that this was Freud fleeing the Nazis, and the advert was hastily withdrawn. However, I won't go on. There's an endless line of free associations along this, but I think maybe some of you willing to take some questions. Maybe some other people want to free associate or ask questions. Yes.
No, it's not fair at all. But that's what I do. Is it fair that it's imposed on me? No, but you know, we live with this. Obviously you're right that London metamorphoses constantly, and either we just sort of let it pass through, or we stand and argue the toss now and again. And I'm very well aware that this particular voice that I'm making is completely redundant in what is happening, because the speed is extreme and a new London is being born at any minute. But, you know, we are biological entities. We have a span, and we have memories, and we have histories that we respond to. And my take has always been, as far as I could, to try and experience a kind of plural time whereby I'm paying my respects to things that have been there before, but also anticipating and thinking about potential futures, so that I'm very engaged and excited by some of the things that are happening now, even though I'm being rude and satiric about them. They're happening, they're real, and they will be the new city. I won't be particularly part of it, but it's there. So, you know, luckily I'm not a politician, so I don't have to contradict myself all the time, and in the way that, you know, a few years back David Cameron and all of the media were saying how appalling it was that Panorama had done this program about the FIFA setup. They actually were banging him on the head for that, and then within a very short time the rhetoric has turned 360 degrees and is saying the absolute opposite. I mean, I do that too, you know, obviously, because I remember I was on Newsnight one time, and I said something at the beginning, and then I listened to what the other person was saying, and by the end I said something that was completely opposite. And they said, but you've contradicted yourself. I said, yes. Isn't that what we do? You know, but you're not actually allowed to do that within this kind of generic setup, is that you have this opinion, he has that opinion, and they go head to head. But that isn't really what happens in life. I mean, if you say something intriguing to me, I'm listening to it, maybe I was wrong. So, you know, that's more or less where I am. I think probably the extracts I read out had a tone of critique of much that was being done now, and also celebration of things I'd noticed from the past, and that may be the overriding aspect of the book. But I can't, you know, say anything more than that's true. Yes, thank you.
I'm interested in the process that happens while you're doing this. It seems to me as if you're a channel of something, of histories in the places where you go to, and I'm wondering to what degree that's intellectual, to what degree it's somatic from inside, and how you experience that.
I think it's initially somatic rather than intellectual. As I said at the beginning, it was a totally somatic, almost dreamlike or song-like thing that I was living in a room at the top of Hampstead, and I just felt the urge to do this strange walk that tucked on things I didn't know much about at that time, but just felt like a way of making some snail trail across London. And I think the initial impulse for all of this is firstly somatic, and then during the process, hopefully, to bring some measure of intellect or research to it, to find out what actually happened, how this was built, who was involved, what were the factors involved, and to build up a kind of narrative, so that it becomes like a structured, almost like a more like a novel than a standard academic work, but based on something as crude in the first place as just like an impulse to get out there, to not censor the notion of taking this particular walk, and to seeing if it does accumulate the energy that would allow it to become a book.
No more questions. Right, so the gavel is about to drop. We are finishing now, but I think Ian is prepared to sign books down in the shop. So his book is down in the shop, and he will be signing. And finally, I'd like to thank him very much. As I said, I've already set my imagination spinning. It'll go on following his words, following their lines.
I didn't read out the stuff to do with it, but one of the more thinking of the somatic, one of the things that haunted me was the beginning of my whole take here is based on a performance thing that happened here that I saw the film of, which was Brian Catling and an artist called McGillivray who responded to the building, and I saw this one of Brian looking at the desk with all of the figurines of Freud and grabbing one and eating it. It was so shocking that how he was allowed to go near the desk at all, I don't know.
That was me, I'm afraid. Right. I've still got the remnants or the lower half of
right.
The
statue. So, I had to work my way around this image and I begin and end with that. One with the girl in the garden whose hair was woven into the tree, smoking a kind of Freud cigar and a big coat, and then finally the eating of this thing. So they were there. And how I could make any kind of sense of those two images was what the piece was about.
Terrific surreal image. Okay, I'd like to thank you once more, and as I said,